This is Rabbi G, and welcome to Harvard God and Gen Z. The goal of this podcast is to discuss life's big questions with some of America's brightest young minds. We will discuss Harvard's continued sway on the imagination as the peak of success. We will discuss how to get there and what it is like when you do. We will then shift to discuss if and in what ways meaning and God are relevant features of Gen Z. What better place than Harvard for discussing these issues with the thought leaders of tomorrow? Welcome to the second episode of Harvard, God, and Gen Z. We are very honored today to have the remarkable Aaron Miller, graduated Harvard 2 years ago. And as far as I know, he is now working for the MBA, doing advertising and marketing for the Latin American market. Welcome, Aaron Miller.
Thank you, Yoni. All good. I'm actually in your hometown, Chicago. So
wow, I am jealous. What a holy, holy place. Second to Jerusalem. Really a little bit jealous that you're there, taking advantage of all the – you're not getting the full advantage, obviously, as things are locked down, but hopefully you're getting something out of it. But Aaron, tell us a little bit of who you are. Where did you grow up, Aaron? What was your background like? Who are you?
Okay, so short story on me is I was born in Montreal to a Sephardic Moroccan mother and an Ashkenaz father when I was around 2 years old. And I should mention my younger brother, David. He also went to Harvard. He was a year younger than me. So when I was two, David was one, we moved to New York. My dad was an architect. He always dreamed of working in development in New York. So we moved there. I grew up in Westchester, a suburb right outside the city, went to Solomon Schechter, a conservative Jewish day school. We lived in Maryland for a while in middle school, where I went to a pluralistic Jewish day school. We ended up moving back to the same area in New York in high school. So I would consider New York really where I grew up, and went to Harvard for 4 years, studied government and Spanish. And for the past 2 years, I've been living in New York. And for the past year and change, I've been working for the MBA.
Beautiful. So tell us a little bit, okay? Harvard, how did you get in? It's a 5% acceptance rate, maybe under 4.8%, I believe. What did you grow up in a family that really pushed education? Was Harvard the goal of the family? How did you end up excelling in high school? What did your parents do right? Or was it a lot of pressure? How was that experience?
It's funny because whenever I say that I went to Harvard and David also went to Harvard, my brother.
Or do you say you went to Harvard or do you say you went to school in Boston, Aaron? What do you usually say?
Oh, I went to school in Boston.
Of course.
But the first thing that anyone ever asks is when I say both me and my brother went to Harvard is, did your parents go to Harvard or did your grandparents go to Harvard? And the truth is, no, my dad went to Tulane. My mom went to McGill in Montreal. And really, from a young age, there was never any talk about Harvard. There was no pressure. My parents definitely put an emphasis on education. My mom, from the time before I could even read, she would bring me to the library and read with me. She was really passionate about being an involved parent, educating me. And same thing with my dad. My dad was, you know, the type of father who every single newspaper article that I would write in high school, he wanted to edit it and help me and help refine my writing style. But there was never really a push from my parents that you have to get this on the SATs, you have to go to Harvard, whatever it was. But that was kind of self-imposed because from eighth, ninth grade, I was really passionate about politics and Harvard was the place I wanted to go. I knew that.
How did you know you wanted to go to Harvard? Because just the name or it was special for politics?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is when it comes to any elite university, the name is half the reason why people want to go in the first place. And I was just interested in politics. That's something that I got interested in from living in DC. And, you know, Harvard with the Institute of Politics, all the big name professors is pretty visible in government. So, you know, once I latch onto that idea, it just became my goal.
So in other words, first your parents were just naturally involved with you, just interested, but never pressuring. And then on your own, you kind of came to the realization this is something you wanted. And then you made a push for it. Did you do things special in high school to actually make it happen once you had the dream? Did you do extra extracurriculars just to make it happen? Or you just followed your passions? How did you make that dream come to reality?
Yeah, so I did a lot with politics in high school, and it's funny because now I work in something that's so outside of politics, working in sports. Although these days, you know, politics is mixed with basically every industry. But I was really interested in doing internships all across politics. So I worked for a New York City mayoral campaign. I worked for the DNC one summer for Senator Gillibrand's office. And then I was really involved in this debate organization called Junior State of America, where they essentially host these big debate conferences that kids will come from all over the country, talk about issues. And that was my big, my big extracurricular activity in high school. It was debating these issues and getting people more civically engaged.
Beautiful. And did you actually like these extracurricular activities, or the whole time, like, okay, this is just a means to an end, so to speak, throughout? Or did you really enjoy them and find you were getting
some? Yeah, I loved it. In high school, politics, civics, that was my calling. That was, you know, everything I read about. Those were all the classes I was interested in. I was so passionate about building up that club at school. I was also on the basketball team that I was crazy about, and that's actually a passion that's carried over to today. There was definitely some other stuff that I did. I think I was on student government as a class representative that maybe carried a bit less meaning for me. It felt like checking the boxes. But overall, I would say I was really passionate about the stuff I did in high school.
Beautiful. And were you ever overly stressed or anxious to the point, if I don't get in, this is all for nothing? Or were you just, okay, I'll see what happens. I'm okay if it doesn't work out. I enjoy what I've done so far. What was your internal state back then?
You know, it's funny because the way I look back on it, I see high school as one of the hardest working times of my life, even more so than Harvard. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. This better? We could edit, I assume, right? Okay. Let me restart. You want to ask the question again?
Yeah, just tell me more about your internal state back then. Were you prepared? You know, if it didn't work out, you'd be fine. Were you very anxious and stressed about making this work?
Got it. Okay. Yeah, high school, the way I look back on it, it was one of the hardest working times of my life. I basically got home. It was a Jewish day school, so we finished school at 4:30. Whenever we had basketball practice, I would get home closer to 6:30 and 7. And basically, I would study until I went to sleep at 11, 12. I think I probably was a bit stressed about the end goal because it was such a tangible thing that I was going for, and it was going to be a yes or no answer at the end of the day. And, you know, in life, especially once you get to the professional world, it's not a binary, like you get into Harvard or you don't. It's okay, maybe you didn't apply to this, you didn't get this job, but then there's another path that opens and there are a million and one industries that you could go into. But I definitely had some stress about whether I would actually get into Harvard at the end of the day, because even though I tell people now, you know, whether you get into the school you want or not, there are going to be opportunities for you and you're going to have a good time. In the moment, I imposed some pressure on myself, definitely self-imposed.
Great. And so when you got the acceptance letter, what was the reaction?
Awesome. It was the most incredible feeling of having worked hard for a goal and achieved it. And I know that they say it's the journey, not the end. But when the journey is so long, you know, when you are working all season and you finally win the NBA championship, you deserve to be a bit happy. So it felt really good in the moment.
Okay. So the dream came true. You show up to Cambridge, you start Harvard. How was that experience? Did it live up? Did you have the political experience that you were looking for? Was it worth all the sacrifice you put into high school? What was your experience like at Harvard once you were there?
So I think 100% it was worth the sacrifice, both from like a transactional perspective, because I think really working hard young does get you ahead. It gives you experiences. It teaches you skills that are worth it at the end of the day. And then, you know, of course, the Harvard credential is something that I'll be happy to use in my career. And from, you know, a personal perspective, I loved my freshman year. I thought I met some of the most fascinating people. You know, I grew up always going to a Jewish day school. I mostly had Jewish friends. I had a few non-Jewish friends from different debate and political activities that I did outside of school, but all my best friends were Jewish and I grew up in the New York area. So all of a sudden I had a roommate who was Chinese and from Texas. I had another roommate who was African-American from California. I lived with a kid from Turkey. I lived with another kid from New York, but he grew up in Manhattan and actually spoke over a dozen languages. So just seeing all of these, you know, different people, all these different stories I'd never been exposed to was amazing. It was the first time in my life.
Was it just interesting, or do you feel like you picked up something from it, learned something from it, and something you take with you in a tangible way, or just being exposed to just a nice, fresh energy?
No. It was definitely more than just, you know, nice entertainment. I was exposed to people who, you know, were more devoutly religious than I'd ever imagined, and people who had never even thought about religion once. I was exposed to people who grew up in red and blue areas, and I think that's probably the best part of Harvard. I know Aaron, in your first podcast, the other Aaron spoke about this, but the people are what make Harvard.
That everyone is working hard and inspired and doing big things, and that just pushes everybody to push themselves on some level.
And sometimes, I'm sure we'll get into this, but that creates the pressure cooker environment.
Correct. So I was going to ask you, so what was the hardest part about being at Harvard? Is it that pressure cooking environment and being around all these excellent people and feeling, hey, I'm inadequate, I'm not a genius, I'm not. I thought I was a genius, maybe I'm not. I thought I was special, maybe I'm not. Was that a hard thing to get over?
By far the hardest part about Harvard was the lack of getting personal on campus. The lack of really paying it. I would say the lack of, you know, human on campus. Because every single person is a figure. Every single person is their own Wikipedia page from the professor.
You're saying even the students, even the students.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I know people from Harvard who are more interested in like building a resume for themselves and building real relationships. But that was definitely the hardest part about Harvard, because everybody's so focused on getting to where they want to be. And look, I was part of that problem also. I was really ambitious in college. I knew I had big career ambitions for post-college. And I was always driven about working hard, getting the right internships, and getting to where I wanted to be. But when everybody's doing it at the same time, there's not really room for sitting to get coffee with friends for 2 hours. Everybody's kind of like right after dinner, right off to the library. Sorry, I don't have time to hang out. Maybe the first week of class, you know, people will spend a bit more time hanging out, but in the middle of the semester, when everybody's just in their groove, everybody's so busy, and it's a crazy environment to be in.
Sure. And so it sounds like at a certain point, even your own ambitions, you realized that there was a need for human interaction, human relationship, and maybe you thought maybe the balance is a bit off over here. You think it could be rebalanced in some way, that human relationship could also be balanced? You think it's kind of mutually exclusive, you have to either choose to be ambitious in life or you choose to be relational. Those two in some way are hard to make work. What do you think about that?
So I think you can definitely reach a balance. I think it's indisputable that you could reach a balance, and there are great people that we both know on Harvard, outside of Harvard, that have that balance. But once you start putting so many of these type A ambitious people into one spot, people start feeding off of each other. And that starts creating the problem. And that's why, let's say you go to Goldman Sachs, you go to McKinsey, you go to any of the most competitive companies in the world, it's kind of the same thing. Because yes, are there, you know, individually good people with the right balance? Yes. But at the same time, once you start putting all those people in the same, you know, fish tank, then that starts getting difficult. And I would say that I didn't realize that when I first got to Harvard. My first year, you know, everything I saw was amazing. Everything was like colored glasses. My second year, I started to think, okay, this place is a bit bizarre. I was only like 19, 20 years old. I started to see some problems, some challenges with people's priorities that I saw. And then junior year, I went abroad. I went to Argentina, your homeland. And that was a good way for me to kind of disconnect from Harvard in the middle of this big rat race. We were focusing on classes and the internships. And when I came back, halfway through my junior year and through my senior year, I think I realized that so many people on campus have underlying mental health problems. A lot of people were not happy. They weren't satisfied. They were super accomplished, but at the same time, a lot of people didn't feel accomplished. And getting towards senior year, a lot of people were lost. They were either doing something that they weren't so passionate about after college, or some people are so incapacitated by not knowing what they want to do that they don't land on their feet after college. And it's not to say that people haven't been aren't successful, you know, right after they graduate. I know most of my friends have amazing jobs, but a lot of people, I would say, don't have like 100% fulfillment that I think you would want to have once you're graduating Harvard.
So that's now that you mentioned the word fulfillment, I think it's a great time maybe to switch gears a little bit about that. So you mentioned that despite the fact that people have reached kind of a peak of secular success, both in getting to the best university and even, as you mentioned, getting the best jobs, but you're saying there's still a lack of fulfillment. What does fulfillment mean to you, and what does it look like to be fulfilled?
Look, I think for me, family and close friends is the number one thing that will always offer fulfillment. Look, how many people are on this earth? 7+ billion people. And then how many undergrads are at Harvard at any given time? I want to say 6,000, something like that.
Sure.
So to think that the idea of fulfillment has anything to do with what these 6,000 individuals are doing, and then the 7 billion plus people have it wrong, it's ludicrous. And I think you can get fulfillment from your job, from doing community service, of course. But at the end of the day, what every single human on this earth has in common is some yearning for relationships, whether with friends, whether with family. Some people are more fortunate than others to have it, some don't. But I think for me, that's always been what I know will mean the most at the end of the day. I would say I've been in the position where I've had certain things and not had others. So now I love my job. I love working at the MBA. I'm thankful every single day to have my dream job. But for the year after college, I was working at a big Hollywood talent agency and I really did not love it. I didn't feel fulfillment. I felt like I didn't get the best treatment from my colleagues. And I was not fulfilled in that moment because I had other things. I had meaningful friendships from having moved to New York. I had my family around, you know, I had my brother. So for me, it's always relationships.
Beautiful. So you kind of are mentioning the importance of what I would call a horizontal relationships. What about a vertical relationship? What do I mean by that is how is important to you and maybe in your experience at Harvard, existential relationship, about understanding kind of the deeper existential questions of life? How much does that play into your everyday life? And do you find that that's something that you would like to develop, or you think, no, it's fine. As long as I have friends and family, I don't need to know why I'm here, how the universe came to be, the big mysteries of life. That I'll just leave a mystery. How important do you think it is to delve into those questions?
For me personally, it's the most nagging question I have in my life of, you know, what role I want religion to play in it, because, you know, maybe it's a curse that I just end up always thinking about what's the bigger meaning. Maybe it's just because I self-impose these standards on myself, but I've definitely always thought about, you know, what's the point of everything? At the end of the day, I took a class called The Meaning of Life my senior year. And I remember it was a philosophy class. And I remember we had a lot of conversations about it. I said, look, I've studied all of these texts. I'm trying to understand a secular framework for the meaning of life, but it just doesn't mean as much as a religious framework. Because
can you tell me what kind of frameworks did they? So again, Harvard has a reputation for being maybe a bashing on some level, even though it used to be a religious college when it's founding. Now I think people pigeonhole it as kind of the bastion for a non-religious framework of life. So yeah, what was the meaning of life class at Harvard like? What framework were they trying to give you? What was the best shot they got?
Well, I think a lot of secular frameworks for meaning revolve around self-improvement and mm-hmm. just becoming the best version of yourself that you can be. But then constantly, whenever I would be reading papers, having these conversations, I would think, so what? Why does self-improvement actually matter? So there are good people right. and there are bad people, and you could become the best version of yourself. But at the end of the day, if everything is just the cosmos and the universe and stars and galaxies, you know, created naturally, and at the end of the day, we're just more sophisticated ideas of that, we're more sophisticated versions of lions who eat zebras, then what does it matter if Aaron Miller, you know, becomes
moral too.
Really educated and is nice to his friends? It doesn't matter.
That's a great point. And also, I was just, you know, how do you define your best self? You know, at Harvard, it could be the best self, it could be your best self in the context of career. when you say best self, what does that even mean? There can be many contexts for a best self, or did they mean in a moral context?
I mean, I think that's the easier part, to align on some idea of morality. Sometimes, you know, it's very easy to align on something like love, like being nice to each other. But yeah, I mean, I guess then you can argue, what does that really mean? And especially when times get tough, it's very easy to say, I am going to base myself on the principle of love and being nice to each other. But then what happens when so much of society breaks down, when there's a global pandemic?
You know, stress.
When there's stress, when there's something on a personal level not going well with in your family, when there are protests across the country because of racial injustice, it's then, you know, when politics becomes so tough, like Democrats, Republicans are on both sides of the aisle, neither side thinks they're doing the bad thing.
Right.
You know, right. both Republicans
think they're righteous, and the other person's trying to destroy society. So it's exactly. That's a very good point. And more than that, I think, but let's say we could get on board with a few core values. Let's say, you know, the meaning of life class to be the best errand means to be a giver. I think most people agree that being more giving is probably a better version than being more selfish. Maybe being empathetic is maybe more better than being selfish. Let's say we can agree on a few core principles. Were there any tools given, kind of a little bit what you're saying, tools given to actually acquire those goals? Like, how do you get there? Because it's easier said than done, I think. And as you mentioned, when the tough get going, a lot of those values kind of go out the window. Was there anything mentioned about how can we actually accomplish those goals?
So the truth is that's really never something that I've explored. I've never explored any sort of atheist community where you might be able to, you know, align on some sort of morality and, you know, have that self-supporting community. So the answer is no. You kind of have to preach it. You have to preach being a good person. But as far as I know, I never really saw any sort of like rule book that, or playbook like the Talmud or Torah might be, or the Quran might be, you know, for atheism.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of mentioned that you are nagged. I was actually surprised to hear you say it so strongly, that the biggest nagging question for you is, what is the meaning of it all, and that this bothers you and eats you up. Do you think that you're alone in this point, and other people either don't need it or are distract themselves away from it? Do you think everyone secretly in your generation is bothered by this question of what is the meaning of it all? But they just don't have a vocabulary or a place to talk about it, and they just kind of, again, use life to distract themselves from the question.
Yeah, I think the word is what you said, distraction. I don't think if a privileged person who goes to Harvard, who has a good job, who ends up marrying someone who's nice, who has a nice family, I don't think they have a meaningless life. I think they could have a very nice life. But at the end of the day, it's you're not necessarily tapping out everything. You're not tapping out all of your potential, because what religion is able to do is it's able to, you know, give you meaning in basically everything you do. That's why I find, you know, your lifestyle so admirable, because you, every single thing you do, from going to the bathroom to eating to praying multiple times a day, that is all imbued in meaning. And I would be lying to myself if I said that every single part of my day is meaningful. You know, I just spent the day, I went to the grocery store with my friends, we cooked a little lunch, hung out on the couch, read my books, I took a day off from work. It's nice, but at the same time, it's not like it's saturated with meaning like the way you might see your life.
Sure. But you made an interesting connection there that maybe you can speak out a little bit, that there's some connection between things being meaningful and squeezing out your potential. Can you elaborate on that? There's something that seems to be an underlying assumption that the more meaningful something is, the more you can accomplish or the more potential you can get out of yourself. Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
I mean, the truth is, it depends on what your goal is out of life. Maybe it's just personal happiness. Maybe it's some like greater idea, which is how God wants you to act. Maybe there is some like standard for morality. I guess it's however you want to live your life. But I would say happiness and well-being is a very easy barometer for meaning. because I think that's what everybody wants in 2020. People just want to, you know, eat well. They want to spend time with friends. They want to have a good family life. Let's just say like happiness and well-being. I think a lot of time religious people are able to are able to make the most out of that happiness and well-being by imbuing their life with this meaning, by, you know, convincing themselves that every single act that you do during a day actually has divine meaning. I don't know if it's true or not. I think the fact that I like prize intellectual honesty and I'm not really sure whether all of this is true is the reason that I'm not just on board and I'm not an Orthodox Jew today. But I think if you could convince yourself of it and get yourself on board, it's a pretty great way to give yourself happiness and well-being.
What do you think is your biggest block when you say intellectual honesty? What do you think is that block that, you know, it could be, but I'm not 100% sure. What is that particular intellectual block for you personally that stops you from maybe buying in all the way or taking it more seriously?
I mean, I think the intellectual block is the fact that you can't really prove God. And I think most rabbis would tell you it's not really about proving it. It's about faith. And, you know, I understand that. But at the same time, there's also some sort of emotional blockage that I think I probably have from over the years, being raised Jewish, going to Jewish day school, being forced to put on tefillin and pray when I didn't want to, when I think I went through all of high school. And, you know, I could count on a few fingers how many times I actually wanted to pray, how many, and, you know, fewer times that I actually thought I was talking with God. So after so many times of just being expected and required to do something, you know, I don't want to do it.
Sure.
That's just my visceral reaction. It's very tough to bring myself to want to pray when I spent so many years in Jewish day school being forced to pray. So it's so hard to want to study when I had this stuff shoved down my throat without any choice.
Sure.
And especially the expectations, you know, there are so many different expectations of what it takes to be part of a practicing Jewish community, keeping kosher, you know, keeping Shabbat in a lot of communities. And I think just the expectation of that is enough to deter a lot of people.
It's overwhelming in your mind.
Exactly.
Sure. Although I would say that for many people, they would look outside at the Harvard community, for example, and say, man, to keep up at Harvard is impossible. It's everyone's flying at 100 miles an hour. I could never keep up. But again, obviously, if you see the value in it or you see the what you're getting out of it, you know, there's a way to kind of overcome those blockages. And I guess that's probably true also, people who go into these intense jobs, investment banking, the 100-hour weeks. Okay, yeah, it's a lot, but this is what I'm getting out of it. So I think maybe the key is understanding what does it get you to do those things as opposed to just looking at them as kind of tolls that you have to pay, I suppose. For you, is belief in God intuitive, non-intuitive? And do you think that people secretly do believe, but just we're not in a society right now that allows for the conversation?
I think people love to attach themselves to some sort of meaning. Like I'm in awe of how many friends have taken the Black Lives Matter movement in the past few months and really taken it on as their own cause. They've, you know, gone to every protest, they've posted on social media, they've, you know, helped to raise money for charity. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that people really do want meaning. They want to be attached to a cause. They want to be doing what they see as good. They want to be doing something positive. But a lot of young people don't see that meaning as being God. I think it's a really hard thing to, you know, wrap your arms around, because God is almost a dirty word, because yeah, there has been a lot of division around religion, especially in recent years. There's always been division around religion.
I think there's division about everything, though. I think there's division, as you know, between Boca and River, the two soccer teams in Argentina. I think, you know, we see now in society that in the division and just racial injustice has really nothing to do with religion in a way. I think societies find things to divide themselves upon.
I think the problem is religions are inherently conservative institutions, because you're preserving a system from the past and applying it to modern day. And there are definitely things in every single religion that are outdated, I think in Judaism as well. For example, if you explained to your average 24-year-old Jew that the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, was central to the religion, people would be like, today, in 2020, they wouldn't really be able to understand it. So especially—
Oh, Anze, let me try to make it real for you. Imagine if you went around the world, you met a Jew wherever you were, and said, hey, how are you? What synagogue do you go to? And I said, yeah, I go to Beit HaMikdash. You walk down the street, you meet another Jew. You say, hey, what shul do you go to? Like, yeah, I go to Beit HaMikdash. Can you imagine, right? We walk around the world nowadays. What synagogue do you go to? You know, the first question, the third question you ask a Jew, what synagogue do you go to? Oh, I go here, I go there. What denomination is it? Oh, I go over there. It's a little bit left, a little bit right. Everyone's in their own world. Imagine the world where every Jew you meet goes to the same synagogue. You tell me that's not an amazing, aspirational, beautiful idea that we should strive for every single day?
It would be an amazing kiddush.
For sure. Tons of herring, for sure. No question about it. It would be a great kiddush. But more than that, there'd be some sense of unity.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
I think it's beautiful idea. I can't imagine a more beautiful idea. And something we need more than ever is some sense of unity. A 24-year-old wouldn't want unity.
Look, I'm just saying, at the end of the day, when so many young people, especially at a place like Harvard, are really progressive, it's hard for them to get on board with something that is conservative.
I understand, but I don't think those are, I think, two separate points. I think, I don't know if religion has to be conservative, first of all. I think all liberal ideology is actually based on religion, which is the dignity of man. If you read Yuval Harari in Sapiens, he discusses this at length, that at the end of the day, liberalism borrows from religion to give an inherent dignity to a human being. That's what all justice is based on. There's actually no basis on this in science. If you take a complete material perspective on the world, you can't get there. So all of liberalism is based on religion, and all conservatism in some level, maybe as you said, is maybe can also be rooted in, but I don't think religion is inherently liberal or conservative. It depends which value you zone in on and how you apply it.
Right.
But I'm just zooming back for a second and just want to understand again, I want to zone in on that nagging that you felt and you feel. And just before we get to specifics about rebuilding temples, just the basic idea that the world was created and how that can impact a person, just knowing that little piece that, okay, this world is not random, there's a purpose here. What can that do for someone? And is there an artificial block in society and how people are being kind of taught in schools to not go there, but it's an important piece missing?
Could you rephrase the question?
The question is it not, number one, very beneficial to understand that the world was created with an intent and purpose? And number two, isn't it at the end of the day, in a way, the most logical way of thinking, given the fact that physical things don't create themselves, that they need to come from somewhere? Isn't that one of the most logical thought processes that a person can have?
Yeah. So on the first question, I think it would do wonder if everybody really believed in God, not just was attached to a religion, but really believed in the existence and, you know, caring nature of God, because it's like having caring parents, you know, that does amazing things for your psyche, knowing that there's something out there that actually cares about you. And then with regards to the second question, I mean, I would say wonder, just looking at the world, taking a break, looking up from your phone and thinking for a second, looking at the ocean, looking at the sky, and just thinking that everything is here, and just, you know, trying to wrap your head around it. I think for at least me, it points me in the direction of religion.
So given the fact that you have, I know, thank God we've had a beautiful relationship for 6 years now. You've been really quite invested, although some ambivalence here and there, but overall really quite invested in grappling with these issues. What would you say? How would you tell a friend of yours in your generation, you know, it's worth exploring. Don't give up on religion. There's actually a lot to be gained there. It enriches my life, even though I'm still not sure where I stand on it. It still enriches me in many ways. How would you explain that to somebody, a fellow Harvard student or anybody for that matter?
It's funny because I think before, you know, studying with you, I would have talked about the cultural aspect. I would have talked about how the holidays were, are, you know, a really, you know, good way to spend time with family, you know, really, really spend time with family, spend time with your loved ones, be part of a community. I would have talked about how Shabbat, Friday nights, every single Friday, my family would sit down for dinner, which we didn't always do. But ever since, you know, starting to really study more in depth with you, I'd say it's really about the existential piece. It's that everybody's on their own journey. No, you know, a lot of people don't really know if they have meaning, what anything means, even though they're super successful on the LinkedIn level. And, you know, this could bring you a lot of enriching value to your life. And it could actually do wonders for the stuff like the job and the graduate school that you're focusing on too, because it'll give you it'll give you a better, like a healthier mind to approach all that stuff with.
So you're saying the general well-being it provides a person, that's one level of it being worth it, just you'll be more productive that way. And you're saying obviously the second more important piece, that existentially we do all have a nagging need for meaning, and it is still the best way. Maybe old, maybe conservative, but it's still maybe the best way to at least talk about the issues.
Exactly. And that's not even, you know, thinking about the real possibility that God does exist and he's keeping score, not in like a vindictive way, but he really cares about every single mitzvah you do. And in that case, then I probably do want to be doing more mitzvahs than less, because it's going to pay off.
Very good. Aaron, thank you so much for your time and sharing your thoughts on these powerful and important topics. And you should continue to shine, both in the NBA, and you should continue to search and hopefully come to some conclusion at some point before you're 95 years old about what you really believe and what you want to do with that belief. But as always, looking forward to continuing the conversation. We will check in again in the future. All right, wishing you well. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Yoni. Talk soon.
All right.